Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. The North Atlantic right whale are species on the verge of extinction. Saving them will require all of us to not just take interest, but action. The more we know about the right whale and threats to their survival, the better we can help. To that end, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts has designated April 24th as Right Whale Day. Later in the hour, we talk with Terry Walkowitz from Sound Explorations. As part of Right Whale Day, she and her team will use music and interactive sound sculpture to represent the movements of right whales, allowing people with visual impairments to better understand how the whales feed, surface, and move through the water column. But first, joining us is Michael Moore, marine scientist and veterinarian at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Michael works with the federal government to determine the cause of death for protected marine animals, including right whales. He's also author of We Are All Whalers, The Plight of Whales and Our Responsibility. Michael, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you.
So you've been out on the water monitoring Atlantic right whales in Cape Cod Bay for the last few weeks. What have you been seeing?
Well, we've been seeing right whales that look pretty good. They're in reasonable shape. There aren't as many as there were earlier in the spring, late February, early March. There were a whole bunch. Center for Coastal Studies, I think they caught kind of over 80 at one point. But now, this week we saw about 10. They were still feeding below the surface. For the work we do with a drone, if they're skim feeding with their bodies more out of the water, we can measure them more accurately and easily. But the ones just under the surface, we can deal with that. And so, and we did see a mom wolf with her calf on Monday, and calf looked great and was popping up to breathe and then going back down to plug in one more time while mom carries on feeding. This is the extraordinary thing about up here. The moms have to feed, and so there's no waiting for the kid and just hanging out and then say, okay, fine, you're done feeding. She feeds and suckles all at the same time continuously.
So you're out there with a drone,
yeah,
gun, and your hope is to gather what measurements? Is that what you're basically looking for?
Basically, this study we've had going on since 2016 and previously in the early 2000s as well. But most recently, 2016 on, every year we get out there with a small boat and a small drone and a camera with an altimeter on it. So the altimeter will tell us how high we are off the water. And the camera, we know its geometry, and so from that we can calculate the length and the width of the animals and get a sense of how they're growing and what condition they're in from the width. And that allows us to look back at data on the same animal because we can identify the individuals. So through time, we can check out how their health is doing and how their growth is doing. And one of the things that we've seen is that for the work we did back in the early 2000s and this recent work, if you were a female right whale born in, say, 1980, you could expect to be a meter longer than if you were a female right whale born most recently. So the expectations, they're stunted, is one of the issues that we're facing.
Where do we stand with numbers as of this conversation and the numbers of calves we've seen this year?
Right. Well, the best number recently is about 340, and that was a drop from around close to 500 14 years ago in 2010. The calves for this year started out well. There's been 17 new calves, and that's a good number. We've lost at least two, probably three, maybe five, and, you know, that's always depressing. But, mammals tend to have perinatal deaths, and so, you know, it's part of the business. But two of those animals were killed by ships, and that should not have happened.
Yeah. Where do they give birth?
They give birth east of northeast Florida and east of Georgia as well, in coastal waters down there.
Tell us a little bit about their migratory route.
Sure. The moms give birth there. They'll bring them up to Cape Cod Bay this time of year, and then south of the islands, Georgia's Bank, Gulf of Maine, south of Nova Scotia, up and around into the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and then back around. And if they're not breeding, they'll tend to hang out in temperate latitudes. And some of them, we don't know where they go at times, for sure. But they're all over. Essentially, they're the Gulf Stream whale was one thing they were called. And the continental shelf from Florida to Labrador is their home.
What are the biggest threats to right whales? And talk more about why we should all consider ourselves to be whalers.
To be whalers. The biggest threats to right whales inherently are you and me and every other human. And I say that simply because if we as consumers did not demand the goods that are brought by ships to this country, fuel, oil, toys, food, transport, you name it. Those ships wouldn't be thundering through the ocean as they do. And so vessel strikes is a very significant piece of the mortality problem for these animals. And if we as humans were not demanding that and generating the capital to invest in those industries, those vessel strikes wouldn't be happening. So in that context, I like to say that we are all whalers because we're, albeit unintentionally, initiating that cycle of supply and or demand and supply. Mm-hmm. Really.
And I just mentioned there, even when we try to reduce the speeds right. where we have right whales, the ships, I mean, they would prefer not to, right? They want to, they've got to get those. Sure. It's right. a time thing as well. They've right. got to get those goods right. here to meet that supply and demand.
Well, really, in that context, we need to breed a totally different ethic, which includes as a given the fact that we as a society, as a species, need to consider sustainability of the natural world as a given. As without that, we're all going to regret that through time.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's rope.
There's rope. And the rope is both a lethal and a sublethal problem. So the rope, the lines in the water, and it doesn't matter what kind of rope it is. It's a risk for the animals if the rope and the whales coexist in time and space. And so, therefore, if you look at the continental shelf, the primary source of rope line in the water column is associated with trap fishing for lobster and crab primarily. I'm not pointing the finger at the industries per se. It's us, in as much as we have an appetite for lobster and snow crab and other trap caught seafood, we are enabling the banks that loan the money to buy the pickup trucks and buy the boats and the traps to go do it. And without our drive, it wouldn't be there.
Yeah. With the threat of rope, the ship strikes, it's a lot of stress. These animals are stressed, and I think there's been some research. We have 17 calves this year, which is a good number, but there are some female whales that are just too stressed,
right,
to even reproduce. Right. Is that also what's impacting the growth? You mentioned that the stunted growth, right. Is it stress?
I think stress is a very significant piece of the problem. And the stress can be difficulty finding good food supplies, dense patches that they can filter feed on. But also we've shown that the stress of entanglement has a number of different pieces to it. The physical drag of the rope while they're still pulling it along, and most animals get disentangled either by themselves or with human help, but a proportion of them die every year. And of the ones that die, we only ever count about a third of them. The rest of them go missing. We realize that latterly. So the stress is drag, but also it's energetic. And so when you're riding a bicycle upwind with a backpack on your back and lots of clothes on because it's cold, you're going to be burning a lot more energy than if you're just swimming along naked in warm water and so on. So the energy budget of these animals is a critical piece to it, and there are many pieces of that we don't really have good numbers for. We actually have a better number for the energy cost of dragging rope through the water than we do the energy cost of foraging, for instance. So the models are dependent upon what data they have. And one of the issues has been that the recent studies by Josh Reed and his colleagues have shown that even minor entanglements can be a watershed change in terms of energy balance, pushing adult females out of the breeding camp into the non-breeding camp. And they're about the same size. There's about less than 70 breeding females and a similar number of non-breeding females who've never been able to contribute to the gene pool. And so essentially they're dead whales swimming because of the cumulative stress they've been under, noise, entanglements, but sublethal vessel strikes and so on.
In a perfect world, what could be done to save the species?
There needs to be a systemic philosophical change in how we value the natural world. And without that as a given, we're going to struggle to do what has to be done to save this species. Mm. And it's really a totem for the natural world in general.
Why are we seeing misinformation linking whale deaths with wind farms?
Oh, boy. Essentially, we seem to be in a political era where facts don't matter so much as whatever the flavor of the cake suits our appetite for today. So, for instance, the lobster industry in Maine lobbied successfully for a moratorium on new conservation measures for right whales through 2028. And that became part of a omnibus bill in, I think, 2022, maybe. Anyway, since till then. At the same time, the stress on right whales of offshore wind by the same political lobbies has resulted in them being used as a tool to vilify the offshore wind. There's such complex and in many ways totally different comparisons, but it does seem as though that the information machine cherry picks what information they want to make the point of the day without any particular focus on the facts. And the facts are that the primary causes of death of right whales are vessel strikes and entanglement. Yeah.
Research is ongoing about right whales, and you talked about we're learning a little bit about the centered growth. What other new information do we have about right whales?
Where they go is a big challenge, and it's a big matter of debate. And so one of the questions is, to what extent could implantable tags be used in these animals to better inform where they go? The information about distribution primarily today comes from aerial surveys, shipborne surveys, and incidental sightings from vessels. That, of course, assumes that you know where to look, and that the tagging piece of it is something that would be really, really valuable. But at the same time, given how rare these animals are and the fact that the cost to the individual of these implantable tags that will be necessary to do that are significant in the eyes of the individual, and obviously the science will look at the cost to the individual versus the benefit to the species. But my perspective is that we should only start burdening these animals with further trauma from tagging when we have successfully stopped the trauma that we know is existing in the known habitats in our own terrestrial waters. And that's my perspective. But what's new, I guess, is that the question of tagging these animals has become more of a current topic again in that context.
Yeah, something we're sure to hear more about. Yeah.
I suspect we will.
Michael Morris, marine scientist and veterinarian at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He works with the federal government to determine the cause of death for protected marine animals, including right whales. He's also the author of We Are All Whalers, The Plight of Whales and Our Responsibility. Michael, as always, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for the invitation.
Coming up after a break, using music to teach concepts in right whale behavior. We talk with Terry Walkowitz from Sound Explorations. Stay with us.
There are two over there. Two more over there. There's one more over there, and there's a Coast Guard ship there, too. Right whales. North Atlantic right whales.
Whale enthusiast Scott Daltonic on Sagamore Beach.
There's a survey today that I read about said there was over 100 in the bay. So that's really great, considering there's only 500 left on the planet. It's not every day you can just get in the car and go see these incredibly huge animals. Whales are amazing, and if you get a chance to spend any time with them at all, your outlook on nature, the environment, oceans, life, it just changes forever. Honestly, I'm just like so fascinated by these brilliant evolutionary like geniuses who are just like so huge. They eat the tiniest little foods. They're so smart. They're so social. I love them so much.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.
You're listening to The Point. If we're going to save the Atlantic right whale, people must understand their plight and why protecting them is important. But ocean habitat is remote, even for scientists. How can people who live thousands of miles away from the ocean gain an appreciation for the species who live there? Drones are one way to capture footage of Atlantic right whales, but these incredible images are not accessible to those with visual impairments. Terry Walkowitz and her team at Sound Exploration compose music and interactive sculptures, allowing those with visual impairments to use hearing and touch to better understand concepts in marine science. Her most recent work focuses on right whales and how their feeding behavior and movement through the water column puts them at risk for entanglement and ship strikes. Terry Walkowitz, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So last time you were on the program, you were working on projects that created music and 3D sculpture models to represent the feeding behavior of humpback whales and the stages of succession on a shipwreck, right? So before we talk about your latest project with right whales, tell us a little bit more about the benefits of music as a tool in learning.
So just to be clear, I am a musician and music educator. I am relatively new to the field of marine science and conservation. But one thing that I've learned from working with our scientific project partners is that effective, impactful communication to the widest of audiences is really important to them. I mean, communication is key, right? If we want to grab people's attention, if we want to foster in them an understanding that marine protection is a priority, and then motivate them to make decisions or take actions that reflect these values. But what's interesting is that while communication is such a vital importance in this scientific community, it often happens in a closed loop, right? So scientists write papers that are read by other scientists who then write papers who are read by other scientists. And this rich interchange of ideas rarely gets to you and me. And when it does, right, it's usually with a heavy reliance on visual communication, using footage, video, imagery, photography, which then leaves a blind, low vision community further outside the loop. So our goal is to innovate and expand the ways in which we communicate marine science discoveries, conservation, and to provide greater accessibility, impact, and an emotional connection, not just to the blind low vision community, but for everyone.
Yeah. So when and how did you get this idea to use music and sculpture as a means of communicating whale behavior?
In a project that we completed for the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary in 2022, we created a video game where we used music as a means to imitate the locomotion of various species that we find right out in Cape Cod Bay. So they wanted to bring attention to this little fish called a sand lance and how that presence of the sand lance really holds the whole ecosystem together. So we composed melodies that moved like these species and created a musical cycle that was connecting all of their melodies into one musical thought. Mm. And then users on the video game could choose a human impact, like what would happen if we increase vessel traffic, and then listen to hear how the impact of their choices was felt in the ecosystem, but also shown through the music. So while we're doing this, music director David McKenzie composed a melody that imitated the diving and side roll feeding of a humpback whale. And we realized, wow, you know, we can actually be pretty discreet. We can use music to show the actual parts of this feeding behavior. And to learn about this, David Wiley from Stellwagen had shown me this track plot data, which is a software where they go out and they attach a suction cup to the back of a whale. It stays on for like 24 hours and then it slides off. And from that, they create this representation that to me looks like a roller coaster track from like from like Six Flags.
Right.
So I looked at that and I realized, well, I know I can play a melody. I know I can play music that matches everything I'm seeing in this. But wouldn't it be awesome if we could also create a 3D model of the track plot data and then adapt it so that textures and aspects of the sculpture would be able to inform a blind, low-vision person as to the discrete motions of the whale as they're foraging for food.
Yeah. A lot of collaboration to get this 3D sculpture model right, with scientists and the music part of it. What was that collaboration like?
It's difficult at times because I don't have a science degree, but I feel like when I talk to people in this field, especially the experts like Dave Wiley, he explains things to me about the whale is doing. And in my mind, I'm not a very well-rounded person. I know music very well. So when somebody explains something to me, I'm automatically understanding it through musical terms. And that is how I can create that understanding for myself. So it's just a case of then making that external, creating that representation for other people.
So talk about that, composing the music to represent the movement of the whales. They're telling you how the whales move, and then what's happening in your composing brain.
So obviously there's some things that are fairly intuitive. If a whale is ascending through the water column or descending, obviously we can have musical pitches that are ascending or descending. But then there can be more discrete information on that. For example, as the whale is descending, is its fluke, its tail, powering through the water, or is it really just gliding down? To me, that would be a different musical interpretation, because gliding, if the whale's not fluking, we can just have a really fast melodic scale that's descending. But if we have fluke motion, we're going to imitate that up and down motion of the tail with a musical ornament, you know, going ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum, that little bit of up and down motion, or what we call in music a turn, da-da-da-da-dum, that shows that up and down motion of the tail. So that now we're using pitch, contour, rhythm as a way to indicate everything that's happening with that whale as it descends through the water.
So tell us more about the humpback whale sculpture and the music that accompanies it.
We're going to hear some music today.
Yeah, so tell us about that.
So in the humpback whale, we have two sculptures. One is bottom side roll feeding behavior, where the whale is descending down to the bottom. It then rolls on its side and scrapes its head into the sand to encourage those little sand lands to get out so it can
eat them.
Wow, that's pretty much it. Yeah. And so the track of the sculpture, we have the big ascents. Our participant will put their hand on the track and it will go up, 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 up. And there are little bumps, or speed bumps, I like to call them, that are showing every time the whale has that powerful fluking motion. They get to the top and now their hand is descending like on a big hill on a roller coaster. Mm-hmm. But at the bottom, because the whale is side roll, we can use the reorientation and turning of the track to reorient their hand. Their hand is the whale. Mm-hmm. So as we turn the track, their hand is forced into a side position, which is the position of the whale. And then we can just follow that contour. We put a cork stripping at the bottom where there's contact with the ocean floor. This is a very different texture, so that when they reach that point, they're not only turned on their side, but they make contact with the cork strip to know, I am now making contact with the ocean bottom.
All right, so tell us what we're going to hear. Water first, right?
The first one we're going to hear. Oh yeah, this is based on the mother and calf.
Yeah. Okay. Tell us.
So
what we're gonna hear.
This is such a cool paper. I should probably mention the research. This was from a paper entitled "Synchronous Mother and Calf Foraging Behavior in Humpback Whales" by Rennie Tyson, Ari Friedlander, Colin Ware, Allison Stimpert, and Douglas Nowacek. And they tagged a mother humpback and her calf, who was like about 8 to 10 months old. In this tag data, they observed how the mom at this point, this is so relatable, the mom at this point, the calf is getting ready to be independent. And so like any mother who's cared for a young one for a long time, it's time that I need to focus on me, right? So the mother is definitely interested in regaining her strength and energy and doing a lot of feeding. At this point, the calf has to go with her. So the calf will descend down through the water column with mom, and then mom does something called lunge feeding, where they see a mass of prey down lower in the water, and they kind of open their mouth, and then they ascend a little bit to take their prey in, and then make a little arch shape to go back down. The calf is doing these same behaviors, but like 5 seconds behind mom. And in this excerpt, you'll hear them descend to the bottom, do of several lunge feedings, and then ascend. And things to notice, you'll hear the calf will be behind mom, so you're going to hear almost like an echo of the same melodic shapes of the mom being heard in the calf. The other thing to notice is on the descent and ascent, calf's much smaller. It's more buoyant. So on the descent, you're going to hear mom basically gliding, but the calf melody will have to power a little bit with more fluke motion. And then the opposite happens on the ascent. Now the calf can just be ascending to the surface and mom's got a power. So you'll notice the melodic ideas will imitate the greater fluke motion from either one, depending whether we're descending or ascending. So before we play it, I thought it'd be great if we could acquaint our listeners with the different sounds they're going to hear. So we'll start with, this is the sound of the environment of the water. And now let's get acquainted with the musical instruments that will represent the mother humpback whale. And finally, let's hear the musical instruments that will represent her calf.
It's fascinating how you can put all that together and visualize that through music. That is amazing.
And now when we hear the piece, you'll hear all of those combined and to observe the different ways that they're foraging together with the calf lagging a little bit behind mom.
Two things are going through my mind. First, the gracefulness. You can just see in your mind's eye the gracefulness of the woods. But also, there's a meditative quality to that, which you find under the ocean.
Absolutely. It's David McKenzie just can create this environment. And it's challenging because if we want to call this data sonification, which is a term that's used when you're creating a musical representation of data, right?
Right.
I feel like there's this range. One end of it is like, okay, we are going to place a pitch value for every numeric value in the data. And when you listen to that, it's like, that's not music. It's not really informing you about, it might be informed about the data, but it's not going to create an emotional response. And then the other end of the scale, it's like, I'm thinking about the ocean. I'm going to write a piece of music and I'm thinking about the ocean, but nothing is really relevant to scientific information about the ocean. But David McKenzie can find this place where he can accurately represent the data while still giving you that emotional experience that we all can appreciate through music.
Now, participants also have an opportunity to create their own sculpture models and have musicians perform their creations, right? So talk about the interaction between the participants and the musicians.
This is something that I wasn't really expecting when I designed the project. I wasn't too sure how the response was going to be. As the musician is right next to the participant as they are taking their hand to traverse the sculpture. But what's so interesting is the discussion that happens between them. A lot of times the participant will be asking the musician to interpret something about the whale motion through a specific means. For example, remember I told you about the musical ornament to represent a fluke stroke? Mm-hmm. I remember one time we had a student from Perkins School for the Blind who asked, instead of doing that musical ornament, can you just make a strong attack, like an accent on the beginning of the note? Because that, to that person, was the way that they could understand sonifying the flute stroke. So the musician is there to interact and create something together. It is a true duet. And what also is so awesome is that the musician will stay in time with their hand and also take elements of how forcefully, how much weight of the hand is on the sculpture model, because they are the whale, mm-hmm. and then interpret that through the musical performance. We've had so many participants that are just so moved by the experience. I remember one gentleman who was in an adult vision loss support group said, I listened to a whale documentary just this past weekend, but now I got to experience it.
Yeah.
And then we do believe, you know, the creative process is important. This is absolutely using the arts in a way to be a communicator of scientific concepts. So we created these things called animal motion path makers. The same sculptor, Emily Grossman, who created the sculptures, also designed these. And it has a pegboard base that has a plastic tubing that can be molded into any shape. It will hold its shape, but then you can mess it up. So they will create and craft their own whale motion melody and then run their hand along that path maker, and the musician will play their original piece. So it's a way for also them to have a chance, learn about these behaviors, but then create something of their own.
So the response of the participants has been great.
Yeah. I'm not crying as much after each one. Like the first one, I was a mess.
Yeah.
But, you know, just the response, I remember there was a young boy named Daniel. He came twice. He wanted to do it again. And I remember him saying to his friends, remember, you're in control, meaning that the musician will follow you. And he was so proud of that. And responses from other students who said, I remember I was leaving and I heard somebody say, I want to go on a whale watch. And I just didn't think about it. But then when I was in the car, I thought about that statement for a minute and I thought, okay. This blind participant wants to go on a whale watch. And what I love about that is that we've given them enough of a foothold of an understanding about whale behaviors that being out there and hearing the sounds, that person could absolutely feel a connection to what was happening.
Right. We're talking with Terry Walkowitz from Sound Explorations, a nonprofit that composes music and interactive sculpture to convey concepts in science and conservation. And we'll have more after a quick break.
Yeah, we watched humpback whales. You know, it's a lot nicer than the whale watch, you know, up in Provincetown, because, well, first of all, it doesn't cost anything more than, you know, I've already got invested. Secondly, it's not as crowded as the boat.
Roy Reining at the beach in Truro.
It's a nice way to enjoy cetaceans, whales. It's a nice way to enjoy them, you know, without having to go through driving and parking the car and buying a ticket and waiting in line and getting on a boat and fighting the crowd to get a spot on the rail of the boat to see the whale when the captain finally gets up close enough to him. And then you got the issue of some folks get a little seasick.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH. Online at capeandislands.org.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Terry Walkowitz from Sound Explorations. The organization uses music to convey concepts in science and conservation to those with visual impairments. In advance of Atlantic Right Whale Day on April 24th, she and her team are unveiling a 3D sculpture and music associated with right whale behavior. All right, Terry, tell us about this project.
So this sculpture is based on the North Atlantic right whale. It was taken from research papers, one of which was called Foraging Rates of Ram Filtering North Atlantic Right Whales, and the other one was called Summertime Foraging Ecology of North Atlantic Right Whales. And what we learned from these research papers is that North Atlantic right whales do a lot of different things depending on where their prey is. One is skim feeding, mm-hmm. which is when they're feeding on the copepods that are drifting at the surface. A lot of times they'll just go slightly down below the water, maybe 5 meters. And here we can see where there could be a problem for a ship strike in that they're dark colored, they're not visible. And if you're feeding right below, the mm-hmm. surface of the water, it's not a good situation, and also being close to shore. And then they do these other two behaviors. One is called a V-shaped dive, where they just go down and they're like, is there something better down there that I'm missing? We call it FOMO, fear of missing out. So the whale will dive down just to see, like, maybe there's something better below and then come right back up. So we start with the skim feeding. We do a FOMO, fear of missing out dive. And then there is prey down in the water column. So the whale will do what's called a U-shaped dive. They will go down to not quite down to the bottom, but where the prey is, and they will essentially skim feed, but now we're under the water, and then come back up. It creates this beautiful U shape. So we combine these shapes to tell our story, even though, depending on where the North Atlantic right whale is feeding, a lot of times, like, they'll primarily skim feed out here, whereas when they're heading really farther north, the prey might be down lower, but we really wanted to tell a story with this whale. So we created a three behavior sculpture.
So we have an excerpt of right whale sculpture. Set it up before we give a listen.
So we'll begin with the whale skim feeding at the surface. You'll listen that there is steady fluking motion. They have to overcome a lot of drag from all that water. And then you're going to hear the whale descend to do the V-shaped dive, go down, come right back up, and then decide, yes, there's better food. We'll head down and do a longer U-shape.
Using music and touch is a wonderful teaching tool for those with visual impairments, but it can also be a great teaching tool for anybody, right? So have people in the sighted community had a chance to interact with the sculptures and music? And if so, what was that reaction?
I'm actually going to be taking the project to Youth Opportunities Unlimited, which is an after-school program for New Bedford city kids. I think just in a few weeks I'll be there. And You're right about that. Obviously, this is designed to be accessible for BLV community. But when any time that you deal with multimodal methods of education, it's just sound education. Because we know that the more senses that you combine in a learning experience, you have better understanding, you're going to have longer memory retention, and better engagement. So in traditional education, right, a lot of reliance on written and spoken word. But we know that there are other ways to communicate concepts to kids. Right. And by incorporating the physicality of working with the sculptures, adding that musical element that's reinforcing the same shapes, you know, we use the term synchronous multimodal learning experiences. And then the idea is that more two or more of the sensing modalities at the same time, but then the musician who's performing live is intentionally syncing up the musical concepts, the musical material, to be in time with what's perceived by the hand and by the body. So this idea of multimodal is not new. It's not new to the field of education. It's just we're bringing it to a new area in marine science and conservation where it might appear to be something novel. But absolutely, this has been known for a long time in the field of education to be that this is the way that children learn best. Multimodal, and learning by making connections across the arts and sciences. Yeah.
Sound Explorations also created a musical storybook about the North Atlantic right whale. So tell us more about the Right Whale Wrong Letter Project.
Yeah, we said, oh, let's write a storybook, because we've obviously had experience doing that. Actually, no. When we were learning about the North Atlantic right whale, one of the things I read about was that when they spout, their mist forms a letter V. I think it has to do with, like, it's like a double blowhole or something, mm-hmm. but it creates a letter V. And so I had this idea of, like, what would happen if we had a young North Atlantic right whale who could do every other letter but couldn't get the V? And that's exactly when we started laughing. We knew, like, okay, this is something.
Yeah, we got gold here.
So we decided to write a story about a young North Atlantic right whale named Robley, who's traveling north with his mom, migrating off of the Georgia-Florida coast up to Cape Cod Bay. And along the way, we learn a little bit about North Atlantic right whale behaviors, their communication, their form of locomotion, and their feeding behaviors. And of course, we use music to do that mm-hmm. communication. But when Robley gets along the way, he keeps trying to spout the V, and it's not working. He's got a P, he's got a Q, he's just like, can't quite get it right. And when he gets up to Cape Cod Bay, there's a moment where they have a ship approaching them, and the ship's captain does not see them. And Robley knows that he has to do something to help protect his mom. So he's quite a creative human being. He tells his mom, you spout the V. I'm going to spout a big letter I. And together they'll form a giant downward arrow that rises above the water. And then the captain sees that arrow and realizes that the whales are near, and he veers away to keep them safe. So Robley, while he was quite upset with his inability to spout a V, he found that his use of creativity was able to be useful, and it became a positive trait.
Yeah. Are you going to give us a sample
yes.
of what this sounds like? Yeah.
Sure. So along with the book, we have a QR code that leads to the Right Whale Wrong Letter website. Anybody can go on there. You don't even need to buy the book. You can visit mm-hmm. right now. And we have the full video of the book with an original orchestral soundtrack from David McKenzie. But then I teach little lessons about these behaviors and how we can show them through music. And we have a free music composition software called Ocean Music Studio, where kids can drag colorful shapes up onto a graph to compose V-shaped dives, U-shaped dives, skim feeding. So with the children, a lot of times I'll start with just hearing that rolling, arcing motion of the Robley's locomotion. We can also hear a melody that just skim feeds steadily at the surface. And then, how about a U-shaped dive? So the children can get to know these behaviors through music and then create their own.
Yep. And then we do have an excerpt from the story, so let's give that a listen.
Spring has arrived, and it's time to travel north to Cape Cod Bay. A 1,000-mile trip to get to cool water and their favorite feeding place. Robley follows his mom, because she knows the way. And propelled by his powerful flukes, he arcs through the ocean in a rolling motion. He soars up, and then down he scoots. As they travel, they often stay close to the shore, cruising along the coast. But there can be danger near cities and ports, big ships and fast motorboats. Ships are a danger. They can't see us whales, says his mom as she heads to the surface. Ship strikes are scary. They can hurt us quite badly. Stay watchful. I'm just a bit nervous. Looking carefully round, Robley sees a ship nearing. Not swerving, not veering, it's coming this way. We need to do something. They don't notice us here. How do we keep them away? Then, an idea.
Stay so, tuned.
Right? Yeah, right. So you mentioned this, but where can educators and parents access Right Whale Wrong Letter And how do you hope that they're going to use that?
So they can go to rightwhalewrongletter.com to see all of the book video with illustrations beautifully done by artist Olivia Cucci, music composed by David McKenzie. And then we have our lessons, free lessons on there, both in early learners and for grades 1 through 5. So you can choose your age. And then, of course, who wouldn't want to go and compose your own melodies without having any, you don't need any prior experience in reading or understanding music to be able to compose using Ocean Music Studio, which was coded by my son, Justin Walkowitz. Oh. I got to throw that in there. And I think it's a wonderful way to, again, engage the arts to understand these behaviors of whales and understand and make that connection to why it's really so important that we take notice and we protect them.
Yeah. You are always finding interesting ways to integrate music and science. Can you share any of the other upcoming projects that you're working on that have you excited?
Yeah, well, we're still advancing the Portland, the exploration of the PS Portland, and using music to understand the biological stages of succession that have formed on her shipwreck over the past 125 years. I'm going to be heading up to Portland next week to do a presentation at a symposium to talk about how music can be used to give people a better understanding of these shipwrecks that are really out of sight, out of view for all of us.
Yeah.
And then I'm looking forward to bringing the Underwater Carnival to Osterville in July for their Osterville Festival Day. The Underwater Carnival uses music and animation to allow families and children to compare various species of whales and how they behave. And this is also accessible as well for the BLV community. And Stellwagen Bank will be bringing a gigantic inflatable humpback whale that you can walk inside.
Oh my.
I think it has like the organs inside. Oh, like you can see pictures of them, so you can get a sense of scale. It is a full size inflatable model of a humpback whale. So children can go inside and explore that. So I'm really excited about that. And I hope I can give a shout out to some of my supporters for this coming Wednesday's exhibit at the Museum of Science. We are so incredibly thankful to Sylvie Rosenkalt, who works at the Boston Museum of Science, our friends from Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary, NOAA, thank you, the National Marine Sanctuary Foundation, the William H. and Mary H. Woods Fund for Arts and Literacy, Oppenheimer, BNY Mellon, Ocean Alliance, Served Well Hospitality Group, and we definitely want to thank New England Conservatory of Music and the New Bedford Symphony Orchestra for musicians, and really excited to bring sculptor Emily Grossman and work with other scientists from NOAA who will be attending our event.
Yeah. Sound Exploration's Right Whale Sculpture will be at the Museum of Science in Boston for Right Whale Day on April 24th. But we'll post information about many of their projects, including Right Whale, Wrong Letter, at our website, capeandislands.org. Terry Walkowitz, co-founder and education director of Sound Explorations, thanks for being with us. Your work is so fascinating.
Thank
really
you so much. I really appreciate it.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.
I was just sort of swimming out there, sort of like sunbathing a little bit, and I started noticing like the waves rippling a little bit.
Lifeguard Liam Russo at head of the Meadow Beach in Truro.
I start paddling back and I see this massive oval coming towards me. So I'm my first thought is just like, a shark, this is it for me, I'm done. And then it just slowly curls out of the water and I hear like all the like blowhole noises. You could smell the salt. Literally just 15 feet away from me, the most ridiculous thing, a whale flapping its tail in my face. I could see its fin. It was a humpback whale. It was something like 35 feet, and everyone on shore was just like, their mouths wide open. The whales don't come that close. It was ridiculous.
You're listening to WCAI.